This is edition number 2005 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 20th of February 2026. Hello. You are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today, we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 19th of February, 2026. My name is Simon Musto-Arthur, and my fellow readers are...
Delia Malin,
Pauline Andrews,
and Dorrie Brecken. And on the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 7 and will set at about 5:15.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes birdwatching past and present, the importance of green spaces, bluebirds, and shaking off the February blues.
But we begin with the main news items, which include a cancelled park run, damaged sand dunes, and a request for the government to intervene over the closure of the sixth form in Sheringham. Let's start with those lead stories.
The North Walsham Park Run team decided to cancel last weekend's event after the body of a teenager was found in the town's Memorial Park last Thursday. Emergency services were called to the park around 7 a.m. and she was confirmed dead at the scene. The death is not believed to be suspicious. In a post online, the Park Run team said, "The North Walsham Park Run team have taken the decision to cancel this week's park run out of respect for recent events. The route for the event held on Saturdays includes laps of North Walsham High School playing field and the Memorial Park. Eyewitnesses reported seeing several police and ambulance vehicles in and around the park from around 8 a.m. Officers had put up a cordon around some play equipment. Many have paid tribute online and sent condolences to her family and friends." St Nicholas Church and North Walsham Benefice said in a post, "We pray for this girl, her family and friends, and for the emergency services and others who have been involved in these events today." Lucy Shires, councillor for North Walsham, said, "This is heartbreaking news for our community. My thoughts are with the family and friends of the young lady at the centre of this tragedy. I cannot begin to imagine the pain they are experiencing, and I know many people locally will be feeling shocked and deeply saddened. I would ask everyone to please allow the police the time and space to carry out their investigation without speculation. Sharing unverified information can cause additional distress to those who are grieving. As a community, we must look out for one another in the days ahead. If you are struggling, please speak to someone you trust or reach out for support."
The sand dunes near a small village have been damaged once again by noisy quad bikers. People in Eccles-on-Sea are worried about the condition of the beach to the south of the Bush Estate due to quad bike riders driving up and down at night. Lessingham Parish Councillor Helen Twining, who lives in Eccles, was informed of 5 quad bikes going through the estate and onto the beach at around 9 p.m. last Friday. "The next morning we saw tracks in circles all over the beach and dunes," Ms Twining said. "These tracks also reached an area of the beach where birds nest, like terns and plovers." She also highlighted that quad bikers should not have been travelling through the private estate to get to the beach. Norfolk County Councillor for South Smallborough, Richard Carey Price, said, "It's a problem we have had on and off over the years. It's always concerning to see damage to the dunes, as they are our natural sea defence. I have been a councillor here since 2007, and we have had at least 6 cases of young men driving around the dunes. I have every confidence the police will deal with this." The county's dunes are home to a wide range of plants and animals and play a big role in protecting the public from flooding by creating natural barriers to storms. Under the bylaws for beaches and promenades, North Norfolk District Council has stated, "No person shall ride or drive a cycle or motor vehicle on the seashore or promenade."
A man has appeared in court, accused of assaulting and harassing two of the campaigners who saved a 1950s bus shelter from destruction. Protesters camped out to stop the shelter on Station Approach in Sheringham being demolished and replaced by a new transport hub after Norfolk County Council said it was unsafe and did not meet modern accessibility standards. Andrew Millington, 56, is accused of using threatening, abusive or insulting words to cause harassment to Rob Emery, a campaigner behind the fight to save the structure. He is also accused of common assault against Chris Pearman, one of the protesters who camped in the shelter to resist the demolition. Millington of Church Close in West Runton pleaded not guilty to both offences at Norwich Magistrates Court and will stand trial on October 26th. Both alleged offences are said to have occurred on December the 4th, the day before an eviction notice was served, ordering campaigners to vacate the structure. An emergency meeting on the 10th of December ultimately saw Sheringham Town Council vote not to support the shelter's demolition. Millington was given bail with conditions not to contact each complainant. A previous condition not to attend the shelter was removed because protests were over.
Two people have been charged in connection with a series of thefts across Norfolk. A man in his 50s and a woman in her 40s were arrested on Monday and taken to Great Yarmouth Police Investigation Centre for questioning. The offences took place in recent months and involved the theft of clothing, kitchen appliances, a television and other items from stores in Great Yarmouth, Wroxham, Thorpe St Andrew and Norwich. One of the alleged offences includes the theft of firewood from outside a property in Lingwood in December. Adam Webster, 50, of Post Office Close, Lingwood, has been charged with four counts of shop theft, one count of theft and breaching a community protection notice. Samantha Walker, 41, also of Post Office Close, Lingwood, has been charged with four counts of shop theft. Both have been bailed with conditions and are due to appear at Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court on March the 11th.
Councillors have urged government officials to intervene over an education trust set to scrap A-levels at a Norfolk sixth form. Representatives at North Norfolk District Council have called for action after it was announced Sheringham Sixth Form would not be running any Year 12 A-level courses from September. The Synergy Multi-Academy Trust, MAT, which runs the school, announced the shock news last month, which sparked outrage among parents and fear for the affected pupils. Now Liz Withington, councillor for Sheringham, has put forward a motion for the council to debate in a meeting last night, calling on the regional director for the Department of Education, the DfE, to intervene. She said closing Sheringham Sixth Form would be a profound loss for our town and for the wider coastal community. This is not simply an internal academy decision. It has long-term implications for inequality, workforce sustainability, and the economic future of Sheringham. We are asking the regional director to intervene because our young people deserve opportunity close to home. Ms. Withington described the decision as putting up huge barriers for kids and said it risks widening the gap between rural coastal towns and more connected urban areas. Councillor Callum Ringer has seconded the motion to be brought to debate. He said our community already faces the challenges of rural transport, seasonal employment and limited local progression routes. Removing sixth form provision will increase travel time and costs for families and risks pushing more young people away from education altogether. Services in rural towns are vital, and when they are lost, the impact is felt by the whole community, not just one year group. The Trust had said the students will be able to transfer their application to Reefham College, where transport will be provided following a route with stops at Cromer, Sheringham and Holt. The motion suggests three actions. The first, writing to the DfE to request the intervention and review of the decision to cease A-level provision in Sheringham, alongside a pause until a number of assessments have been completed. The second includes writing to Norfolk County Council for assurance that a coherent 16-plus sufficiency plan remains in place for the town and surrounding communities, and details of alternative delivery models explored. And the third includes writing to Synergy Matt for an explanation of the financial rationale for the closure, with comparative data from other rural Norfolk sixth forms and strategies undertaken to increase recruitment. The meeting was on Wednesday night at 6 p.m. See next week's paper for a report on the meeting.
A fairy-themed fundraiser by a father from Sheringham has captured the support of his town. Kev Pitcher raised more than £4,400 through a 72-hour sponsored silence in memory of his son Benny, who died from an aggressive brain tumour. The challenge, which began at 7 p.m. on January the 28th and ended at 7 p.m. on January the 31st, was in aid of Benny's Battalion Fund, set up in his memory by his family through the Norfolk Community Foundation. Mr. Pitcher said, "Finishing those 72 hours was emotional. Staying silent was unbelievably hard for me, but every moment reminded me why we were doing this. Benny inspired us to help other families going through the darkest of times, and seeing the support from our community was incredible. Knowing that this money will make a real difference brings huge comfort." His six-year-old son died from DIPG, an aggressive brain tumour. Mr. Pitcher collected donations throughout the town and in Sheringham's pubs, with support from the town criers of both Sheringham and Cromer. The challenge ended with a packed fundraiser at Harry's Bar in East Runton and raised a total of £4,455.32. Julie Pitcher, Mr. Pitcher's wife, said, "We never imagined the response would be so huge. Watching Kev push through something so far outside his comfort zone was amazing. The silence at home was a novelty, but what made me really happy was seeing how many people remember Benny and want to help other families in his memory." Sarah Herschel Shawland from the Norfolk Community Foundation said, "Kev's challenge has not only raised an incredible amount, but it has also brought much needed awareness to what families face when a child receives a terminal diagnosis. We are deeply grateful for everyone who contributed."
A yellow cold health alert has been issued for parts of the UK, including Norfolk. The UK Health Security Agency has issued the alert for the east of England. It will come into force at 6 p.m. on February the 17th and last for 72 hours. It comes as a cold snap continues across the UK, with the Met Office forecasting snow and ice for large parts of the country. A spokesman for the Health and Security Agency said, "Forecast weather is likely to have minor impacts on health and social care services, including increased use of healthcare services by vulnerable people. There will be a greater risk to the lives of vulnerable people." The Met Office placed the county under a yellow weather warning for ice from Monday evening until 10 a.m. on Tuesday. Weather 25 previously forecast that Norwich would see heavy spells of snowfall early on Tuesday morning, followed by a lighter dusting at around 6 p.m. Over the coming days, the temperatures will barely rise above freezing.
A chart-topping singer spent Valentine's Day beside the Norfolk coast. Ollie Mears was spotted enjoying dinner at the White Horse in East Runton near Cromer on Saturday evening. The star, who started his career on The X Factor and later shot to number one with hits such as Troublemaker and Dance With Me Tonight, headed to its sister venue, Harry's Bar, afterwards. He treated awestruck crowds to a few songs before posing for photos with fans. But he was not the only famous face in East Runton that evening. Singer-songwriter Lucy Spraggan, who also began her career on The X Factor, had been previously booked to perform at both venues alongside the one and only Adele tribute act and TikTok star Liam C. Several celebrities have appeared at the White Horse and Harry's Bar over the past few years. Katie Price was spotted enjoying a roast dinner with her then-boyfriend JJ Slater and son Harvey in the summer of 2024. Geordie Shore's Chloe Ferry and Nathan Henry and Ibiza club owner Wayne Lineker, brother of England football legend Gary, have also visited. Pixie Lott and Scouting for Girls each performed summertime sets on the patio of the White Horse, and Ollie Mers Hart radio co-host Mark Wright has stopped by multiple times with wife Michelle Keegan and fellow The Only Way Is Essex star James Arge Argent.
Proposals to decide the future of the 1950s shelter off station approach have now been shared by Sheringham Town Council after weeks of being kept secret. And when the designs were unveiled by the leaders of the Save Our Shelter campaign group, Katie Hart and Amanda Selick, to fellow members, it was said many were left shocked. The option included removing the front of the structure and part of the roof in a design agreed by Norfolk County Council. Town councillors have to decide what happens next, while also working closely with the County Council to deliver the project. The Town Council said the designs would allow the artwork to be retained and preserve the curvature of the back wall, while widening the footpath to address safety concerns at the site. But for Rob Emery, who fought to save the bus shelter from bulldozers in a fierce protest in December, this would completely change the character of it. He said, "I feel betrayed. This end result is not what anyone wanted or expected." He added that when the proposals were brought forward to the group, the immediate reaction was of horror. Mr. Emery also said that there had been other viable alternatives which had not been considered by the Town Council, including one that was put forward by architect Bernard Smith in December. Mr. Smith's scheme made minor changes but retained the full structure, only changing the access points away from the pinch point of the pavement and adding a designated waiting area away from the road. However, he said he was told that his design would not work, with no clear reason as to why. The Town Council also deemed the other option of dismantling the shelter and rebuilding it further back on the site as not feasible, as the cost would be in excess of £100,000. District Councillor Liz Withington said, "It is deeply disappointing that Norfolk County Council continues to ignore the clear and consistent message from our community. The latest proposed shelter design, which NCC considers to be the only option, fails to respect or retain the cultural heritage of the existing building, which so many residents value and wish to see conserved. More concerning, however, is the continued refusal to address the bigger picture. This project has always been about far more than a bus shelter. It is about safety. We must now bring safety back to the forefront of this discussion and reinstate the bus stops to station approach as part of a properly planned joined-up solution. This is an important opportunity to improve infrastructure in Sheringham, and it cannot be reduced to a narrow design exercise. Moving forward, a genuine stakeholder group must be established so that the County Council works with, not against, the local council and community to deliver a scheme that prioritises safety, heritage and the long-term interests of our town." The Town Council has said in documents ahead of next week's council meeting, "The priority for Sheringham Town Council has to be the completion of the Ottendorf Green Transport Hub. Council should decide whether to move forward with the compromised design, accepting that this will cost STC in the region of £20,000 on top of the current expenditure since December 2025. The 1950s structure was due to be demolished in Norfolk County Council's travel hub plans, but the work was brought to a halt when demonstrators staged a protest to save it. It will be discussed at the Town Council meeting on Tuesday, February the 17th at 7pm.
Locals in a Norfolk town are divided over the next stage of plans to build a new sports hall at a high school. A reserved matters application for the development was put forward by Reefham High School and College. The plans also included changing facilities and sports classrooms, alongside car parking, cycle storage, a gym and a studio. Some have expressed mixed views over the proposals, with one person saying they were keen to see the facilities improve. They added, "We must build facilities like this in order to promote local sports, sports in schools, and helping keep the community fit and healthy. I can only see the positive outcomes a facility like this will bring the local community, and at a guess, a fantastic revenue stream for the school." However, others have expressed concerns regarding the design of the hall and the provision of parking. One person commented, "The bulky appearance of the hall, towering above the lower ancillary buildings, will be highly prominent when viewed from the south and east from Whitwell Road. Additional parking is now shown directly in front of the classroom studio building. The increased number of vehicles will visually detract from the appearance of this part of the building." In a planning statement, the school said the development would contribute positively to the overall amenity of users and the wider school. They added that the building would support the current and future needs of the school in terms of sports provision and not result in significant impacts for nearby residents. The plans were initially going to be delivered in phases to meet the immediate needs of the school, but this has been changed to go ahead in full. It was also originally intended for the building to have community use out of hours, but this has now changed to be throughout the day.
Live facial recognition technology is being introduced by police in Norfolk to help to find high-risk individuals. Norfolk Constabulary will use the technology to identify wanted suspects and those legally banned from specific areas. The force plans to use it for the first time in Norwich later this year. The system compares faces captured on a live camera feed to a predetermined watch list of people considered to pose the greatest risk. Inspector Toby Gosden said, "Live facial recognition is an incredibly useful tool which can assist officers in keeping the public safe. We have seen great results in other forces across the country, which I am confident we can replicate here in Norwich. We understand there may be some concerns around your privacy and freedoms, which is why we are being open and honest about how it will be used and when. Officers will not be monitoring the local community and their daily business, but instead safeguarding the public by locating dangerous individuals and securing justice for victims of crime. The constabulary will use a marked van supplied by Bedfordshire Police in clearly signposted areas, with officers on hand to answer public questions. The force claims its use of the technology will be intelligence-led, focused on protecting vulnerable people and tackling serious crime. Its system instantly deletes any non-matching facial data, and the watch list is erased following each deployment. The move aligns with the government's police reform white paper, which proposes funding for 40 new live facial recognition vans across the UK. It also includes £26 million for developing a national facial recognition system and £11.6 million to support the rollout and coordination of live facial recognition technology.
Elections will go ahead in Norfolk and Suffolk this year after a shock U-turn by government ministers. Steve Reed, local government secretary, announced Norfolk County Council and Norwich City Council, as well as Suffolk County Council, votes will take place in May. The decision means the authorities will have about 80 days to prepare for them to go ahead. The change in policy was announced by Mr. Reid in a letter he sent on Tuesday. He said he had decided to withdraw his decision to postpone the council elections due to take place in May, in light of recent legal advice. Mr. Reid told the Commons last month the polls would be pushed back following arguments made about capacity, reorganisation and democracy amid a drive to reorganise English local authorities. But on Tuesday, a Ministry of Housing, Communications and Local Government, MHCLG, spokesman said, following legal advice, the government has withdrawn its original decision to postpone 30 local elections in May. Providing certainty to councils about their local elections is now the most crucial thing, and all local elections will now go ahead in May 2026. In his letter, Mr. Reid said the government will provide up to £63 million in additional capacity funding to the 21 local areas undergoing reorganisation across the whole programme, building on the £7.6 million provided for developing proposals last year. He said, "I will shortly set out further details about how that funding will be allocated. My officials will be in touch with those affected councils to understand if any further practical support will be required." Kay Mason-Billig, Conservative leader of Norfolk County Council, has criticised the government's flip-flopping, but said the authority is prepared to hold elections this year. She said, "I note the government's change of mind. I always said we were prepared to fight elections and we haven't stood anyone down, as nothing was ever certain. We can now proceed. I am not surprised at this government flip-flopping, as they don't seem to be able to make any decisions they can stick to. All they have done is waste more time and taxpayers' money. We now need to get on with it." Reform UK leader Nigel Farage said the government's decision was a victory for his party. "We took this Labour government to court and won. In collusion with the Tories, Keir Starmer tried to stop 4.6 million people voting on May the 7th. Only Reform UK fights for democracy." David Bick, who is a Norfolk County councillor and is Reform's candidate for the Norfolk and Suffolk mayorship, believes his party can take control of County Hall after May's vote. Robert Lowe, Independent MP for Great Yarmouth, who has recently announced the launch of his new party, Great Yarmouth First, said the party will stand candidates in every single seat. He said, "Never forget how Labour and the Tories colluded to cancel your elections and steal your vote. Great Yarmouth First will stand candidates in every single seat and we will aim to win every single seat." Tory leader Kemi Badenoch described the reversal as predictable chaos from a useless government that cannot make basic decisions. Alistair Beales, leader of the independent coalition-run West Norfolk Council, said, "I am delighted the government has recognised the strength of community feeling and today reversed their decision to postpone the Norfolk County Council elections. A third of councillors are up for election in Norwich this May. Lucy Galvin, leader of the opposition Green Group at Labour-run City Hall, said, "Today's announcement confirms what the Green Party has argued for months. The May 2026 local elections should never have been postponed." From across the border in Suffolk, councillors reacted to the news. Andrew Stringer, leader of the Green opposition at Suffolk County Council, said, "We welcome the outbreak of common sense." You are listening to edition number 2005 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 20th of February 2026. Still to come, there are items about local planning matters and the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, here are some articles to encourage and entice your attendance at local events and establishments.
Families are spending the half-term travelling through the countryside on a heritage railway. The North Norfolk Railway's 2026 season will mean steam and heritage diesel engines will once again be chugging along the Poppy Line between Sheringham and Holt. During the school holidays until February the 22nd, one of the line's restored steam engines will be hauling carriages from the 1950s and 1960s. A diesel locomotive will also be running alongside a recreated rail car, just like the ones that ran on the line in the 1950s. Young passengers can complete free activity sheets during the journey and even try their hand at railway signalling at the Reedham Junction signal box at Holt. Graham Hewkins, General Manager of the North Norfolk Railway, said, "We're looking forward to welcoming passengers once again. The railway simply isn't the same when trains aren't running. Day Rover tickets allow unlimited travel and the freedom to explore attractions at each station, and passengers who book in advance can make use of a 15% discount."
A church service will take place to mark the anniversary of the war in Ukraine. St. Peter's Church in Sheringham will hold the service at 4 p.m. on Sunday, February the 22nd, working closely with North Norfolk Aid for Ukraine, NNAFU, to mark the anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine and show ongoing support for those affected by the conflict. Reverend Ian Grant, assistant curate at St. Peter's, said, "Ukraine drops off the face of our news when something else happens in the world. We forget about it. Yet the people of Ukraine don't get that luxury. For them, the war is the only news, and it brings fresh horror each and every day. Christ calls us to love one another as we love ourselves, and Christ calls us to look to the most vulnerable." St. Peter's has worked closely with NNAFU since the war began in 2022, hosting annual services and organising donation drives to support those in need. Through these efforts, the community has sent medical supplies, toiletries, clothing, and essential items for children and babies to Ukraine. Ukrainian firefighters have received vital equipment, and Christmas toys have reached children thanks to the church and the wider North Norfolk community. Reverend Grant said, "We hold a service each year to remind everyone that this conflict is still taking place, but also to remind the people of Ukraine and those Ukrainians who currently live in the UK that they aren't forgotten, and that we will keep supporting them for as long as it takes. It means we can say that they are our neighbours and they are loved. We might not be powerful leaders in the world, but what small difference we can make, we will. All funds raised during the service will go towards supporting the work of North Norfolk Aid for Ukraine."
St. Andrew's Methodist Church is hosting a special coffee morning to support fair trade farmers. Dubbed the Big Brew, the event on Saturday, March the 7th, aims to raise funds for Transform Trade, formerly known as Tradecraft Exchange. The funds will assist in ensuring a fairer deal for farmers like Kenyan tea farmer Paul Mgwani Ngunu Wagatahi. He is part of an association advocating for better pricing and purchasing practices. Mr. Ngunu Wagatahi has expressed a desire for more freedom among tea farmers, and he wants consumers to consider whether the money they pay for tea products actually benefits the farmers who produce them. The event, from 10 a.m. to 12 noon at the church on Cromer Road, will have free admission. Visitors can look forward to a fair trade stall, a cake stall, a quiz and a tombola. Sheringham is proud to be a fair trade town. More details about the coffee morning can be found at transform-trade.org/big-brew and sheringhammethodist.org.uk.
The Swan Inn is a 17th century venue which sits right on the edge of the River Bure in Horning. Mitchells and Butlers, which runs the pub among others across the UK, previously lodged plans to transform it. The application, submitted to North Norfolk District Council, outlined a reconfiguration of the seating, screens and drinks shelf, the removal of a raised area in the pub snug area, and the installation of a new coffee station. It has now been revealed that the Swan will be shut between March the 8th and April the 4th, while exciting changes are made. In a post shared to Facebook, a spokeswoman said, "Exciting changes are being made to create exceptionally good memories for you all. In the meantime, we are running our stocks down, which will mean we are offering a reduced menu to be sustainable and reduce wastage. We apologise in advance if the items you were anticipating are no longer in stock and appreciate your understanding. If you would like something in particular, please let us know in advance of your booking and we will do our very best to accommodate."
Two exciting opportunities are on the horizon, offering pupils the chance to engage with their local community and see themselves featured in print. Schools across the region are encouraged to take part and support youngster involvement. At North Norfolk News, we're getting ready for the return of our annual Mother's Day Messages feature, where your little ones can write heartfelt notes to celebrate their mums, stepmums, grandparents and whoever they love the most. These notes will be compiled into a keepsake supplement for families to treasure. Loved ones will be able to purchase their paper on Thursday the 12th of March. Did you also know that 2026 is the year of reading? We are running an exclusive campaign to support this, Born and Read. The campaign is designed to ignite a passion for reading and writing. It will bring together editorial features, community events, competitions and school initiatives, all aimed at making reading more accessible and enjoyable for everyone. That's why we want schools to get involved with our exciting World Book Day spread. It's a day for all children to love and share. We want to feature local schools' best dress-ups from 5th of March. Even if schools aren't getting dressed up and they're doing activities instead, we still want to see it. You can pick up your print copy on Thursday the 12th of March. If you know a school who would like to get involved, ask them to email nnnschools@localiq.co.uk by Wednesday the 18th of February. Participating schools will receive notice boards to ensure parents and carers don't forget to pick up their pupils in print.
The first Born and Read in Norfolk event will take place during the Easter school holidays on Monday, March the 30th, from 10 o'clock till 3 o'clock. Hosted in collaboration with the National Centre for Writing as part of its Family Day, the event will be held at Dragon Hall, Norwich. More details will be revealed in the coming weeks. Keep an eye out for updates at edp24.co.uk/news/education/born-read-norfolk. Books for Schools. Our Books for Schools Token Collect competition launches on Saturday, March the 7th, across all our newspapers, with £12,000 worth of books up for grabs. Simply collect the tokens and hand them into your school. Judging will be based on the number of tokens collected relative to pupil numbers. Prizes include: first place, £750 worth of books; second place, £400 worth of books; and a bonus draw where any school that collects more than 1,000 tokens will be entered into a draw to win one of 75 £100 book bundles. To get involved or find out more, email katie.mcnally@newsquest.co.uk. World Book Day. Don't miss our special World Book Day supplement, which will appear in the paper on Thursday, March the 12th. If your school hasn't yet signed up and would like to be included, simply email katie.mcnally@newsquest.co.uk. Whether pupils are dressing up or taking part in book-themed activities on World Book Day, Thursday, March the 5th, we'd love to feature their photos in our celebratory supplement so that it can be kept as a special keepsake by pupils' families.
Born and Read in Norfolk is a year-long initiative highlighting the importance of reading and writing, delivered in partnership with the National Centre for Writing, headline sponsor RWE, and sponsor Your Garden. Following the campaign throughout the year in our coverage at edp24.co.uk/news/education/born-red-norfolk and on social media using #BornAndRed2026 or get in touch at readingmatters@newsquest.co.uk.
And now we move to this week's Mardler magazine supplement.
Nick Marshall writes, especially for the Mardler, "In addition, 1994, I wrote about the culture and background of twitching, that is, the type of bird watching which involves birders reacting quickly to get to see rarities soon as they are found anywhere in the country before the bird moves on. I'm in my early 70s now and have been a keen birder since my teens. The 70s and 80s were the heyday of twitching, when it first became a thing. Norfolk can legitimately claim to be the best county in the UK for birding, and this article recalls a few of the twitches I did back then in and around the county. Part of the excitement of twitching is the uncertainty. Will the bird be there still? Will we get decent views of it? Or face the dejection of failing to see it? In the 70s, I was living in London, and word went out one evening that a cream-coloured courser, normally found in the deserts of North Africa and the Middle East, had been found that day in a field near Blakeney. Birders around the country mobilised to be there at first light the following day. I and three others somehow decanted ourselves and our equipment into Keith's Mini, the original model, that is, not the current Mini, the size of a Range Rover. We drove to a lay-by at the side of the field to endure a most uncomfortable few hours' sleep in the Mini. The discomfort was of no consequence. All that mattered was that the courser was still there in the morning. It was not. Hours of searching the area produced nothing. The palpable despondency engulfing the little white car on the journey home resembled how I imagine football fans must feel after their team has lost a big match. That day was in stark contrast to a glorious spring day a year or so later and a few miles further west along the coast at Holme. A lesser grey shrike, an extremely rare bird from southern Europe, had overshot on migration and was sitting on telephone wires in the bright Norfolk sunshine. The ecstasy of seeing rarities like this shrike is heightened by the, well, frankly, the grief of failing to see a rarity like the courser at Blakeney. Within sight of Holme is the RSPB Titchwell Reserve. Not all birding is about twitching rare migrants. It's also exciting to see rare British breeding birds. We have many such in Norfolk, none rarer or more spectacular than the Montagu's Harrier, a pair of which bred at Titchwell for a few years in the late 60s, early 70s. Breeding Monty's Harrier is something of a birding holy grail, and the RSPB acquired the site to secure their future. But, as a sombre illustration of how capricious the natural world can be, as soon as the ink was dry on the deeds, the birds disappeared, never to return to Titchwell as a breeding species. Happily, after this somewhat inauspicious start, Titchwell has gone on to become a successful and flagship reserve. Visitor numbers increased exponentially every year as the car park expands, and the cafe and shop almost become destinations in their own right. all part of the drive to make money for conservation and attract visitors. All very different to how the RSPB did things back in the 70s. When to visit Minsmere, for example, you had to apply well in advance for one of the limited number of permits which were issued on certain days only. The ethos was the old-fashioned idea that the reserve is for birds and so people must be kept out. But that put the society at odds with my generation of keen young birders who were intent on getting in. The warden then was the legendary Bert Axel, known sometimes affectionately as Hubcaps. He had the impression that his main task was to keep birders outside the perimeter fence, with perhaps a little light conservation work if time permitted. The old-style sewage farms provided a great habitat for birds. And again, birders were often faced with the problem of getting past on-site officials and onto the banks surrounding the sludge beds. Who can honestly say they don't love a good sludge bed? Wisbeach Sewage Farm was one of our regular haunts, where we had similar running battles to those with Hubcaps at Minsmere. This time the antagonist was a chap by the name of Arbuckle, the site manager, known to us as Crappy Arbuckle, after the jazz musician Fatty Arbuckle. A white-rumped sandpiper, an unremarkable American wader, but a tick for me and many others, turned up there one autumn. The site was besieged with twitchers. We all saw the bird, and the twitch was made the sweeter by spectacle of Crappy and his staff being comprehensively outnumbered and outwitted by the twitchers. Clyde was then the absolute epicentre of the twitching world. To be precise, the centre was Nancy's tea room in the High Street, now a private house, and the George Pub. These were the places at which, in the pre-digital days before mobile phones and apps, bird news, information and gossip were always available. The famous artist, naturalist and writer Richard Richardson was a resident of Clyde and a habitué of the East Bank. A familiar, mildly eccentric figure rarely seen without his sketchbook in hand and trademark motorbike leathers. A truly charismatic man, he inspired me and many others to observe and appreciate wildlife. One day, when there weren't many birds around, he told us where to see the rare bean goose, a small number of which spend the winter on the Broads near the village of Buckenham. Most birders in those days camped overnight. Nowadays, for some reason, it would be called wild camping. But Richard explained that at Buckenham, we wouldn't have to put up with a tent. We could stay at Buckenham Palace. This was, is, a small disused brick-built pigsty at the side of the road, overlooking the grazing marshes used by the geese. We took his advice, went and saw the bean geese, and the palace then became a regular stopover on our winter birding itinerary. Happy days. North Norfolk has changed in many ways over the years, and it's easy to regret the impact of the modern world. Increased population and second homes, etc. In other ways, though, it hasn't changed. The vistas are largely as they were 60 years ago. The coast road is much the same. More of the most sensitive areas are now in the hands of conservation bodies, and the need for conservation has never been higher in the public psyche. Despite the daily catalogue of catastrophic environmental news, there is also scope for some optimism, and certainly Norfolk retains its reputation as arguably the best county for birding.
From the Caravan and Motorhome Club magazine, March-April 2026, David Chapman writes, "Standing by a lake, I hear a thin, high-pitched whistle. It sounds like one of those whistles used to train dogs, but there are no canines to be seen. There it goes again. And this time it's getting closer. Then a flash of brilliant blue low across the water. I try to keep my eye on this teal-hued dart as it disappears into waterside vegetation. but it is never to be seen again. It was a kingfisher, and my experience was typical of encounters with this beautiful little bird. I use the word little quite deliberately. We are all very familiar with the appearance of a kingfisher, because it is one of those iconic species that often makes it into the pages of magazines. But those photos often give a false impression of the bird's size. In reality, it is very small, about the size of a sparrow, and it tends not to come very close. Plenty of anglers reading this article will have observed kingfishers close up and even seen them land on their fishing rods. There are two good reasons why fishing enthusiasts get better views than the rest of us. They sit quietly in appropriate places for hours on end, and they offer the perfect perch. And I'm not talking about the fish. Kingfishers are very focused and single-minded. If they see a perch in a nice position over the water, they will gladly rest on it and won't necessarily notice a person nearby, especially if they're in camouflage. They also take readily to newly positioned perches, which offers great opportunities for wildlife photographers. Kingfishers usually start breeding from late March, but during a mild winter it can be as early as February. Either way, it will be a busy time for this feisty territorial bird. After establishing a breeding site near a sandy riverbank, the mates will dig a tunnel, up to 1 metre deep, in which they will lay their eggs. A brood usually contains between 5 and 7 eggs, and the pair will generally raise 2 or 3 broods each year, digging out a new tunnel for each one. It is believed that the kingfisher pair will sometimes need 100 small fish per day to feed their youngsters. So it is easy to imagine the unpleasant smell that engulfs a well-used nest. Kingfishers are one of the easiest birds to distinguish. Their breasts are fiery orange. They have creamy white flashes on the chin and neck, and the rest of their plumage is blue. And given a good view, it is simple enough to pick out a male from a female. The main difference is that a male has a black beak and the base of a female's lower mandible is orange. In fact, the blue we see on a kingfisher isn't created by pigment. It is an illusion of light refracting through the microscopic structure of its feathers. We call this phenomenon structural coloration. The kingfisher certainly lives up to its name. This tiny bird can dive straight down into the water at about 25 miles an hour. Judging the refraction of light through the surface of the water, it will pinpoint a fish, catch it and return to the surface in the blink of an eye. In fact, its eyes have nictitating membranes, semi-translucent protective covers that offer protection during a dive. Other key adaptations lie in its streamlined shape and pointed beak, which allow a smooth transition into the water. While the kingfisher's common name needs no explanation, its scientific name, Alcedo athis, points to a rich mythological association. The family name Alcedo has the same origin as the word halcyon, and both are derived from the Greek mythological character Alcyone, a moon goddess. It is said that she gave protection to fishermen from winter storms, traditionally during the period around the winter solstice that was free of storms, which became known as the Halcyon Days. The story continues that Zeus defied Alcyone's control of the weather, sending a thunderbolt which destroyed the ship carrying her husband, Ceyx, who was killed. In her grief, Alcyone threw herself into the sea. Instead of drowning, she was immediately transformed into a kingfisher. Unlike Alcyone, we can be fairly certain that kingfishers, problematically for them, have no control over the weather. They find it difficult to catch fish when the surface of the water is made choppy by wind, and they have no chance of fishing if the water is frozen. This is why many kingfishers venture down to estuaries where conditions are milder during winter. In fact, it isn't uncommon to find kingfishers around the coast, fishing in rockpools and harbours over winter. As these places suffer a shortage of perches, you are more likely to see them hovering before plunging into the water. It's always a privilege to see a kingfisher. Remember, when you are beside a river, listen for a dog whistle and keep your fingers crossed that there aren't any dogs around.
In the National Trust magazine for spring 2026, John Orner Ornstein writes, "Our lives are overcrowded, overexcited, overstrained. We all want quiet. We all want beauty. We all need space." National Trust co-founder Octavia Hill's 1895 words still ring true today. She believed that nature wasn't a luxury, but an essential part of a full and happy life. That belief led her to set up this conservation charity, dedicate her life to the protection of green spaces for people and nature, and find ways to make sure everyone could enjoy them. Her vision is the reason the Trust's new strategy continues to put people and nature at its very heart. More than a century later, science confirms what Octavia instinctively knew, that spending even 15 minutes in nature can improve your mood, reduce blood pressure and heart rate, and help you focus. Many people find meaning, beauty and purpose in the natural world. And of course, when green spaces thrive, so does the wider ecosystem. Yet nature can feel out of reach. Even though 85% of the UK's 70 million strong population are town and city dwellers, a 2025 official statistic from DEFRA, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, shows fewer than half the people in England live within a 15-minute walk of a good quality green space, which is free to access with a variety of plants, trees and wildlife species. In some areas, this drops as low as 1 in 10. For too many people, their only daily glimpse of nature might be through a screen. That's why a coalition of organisations including the National Trust, Natural England, the National Lottery Heritage Fund and others has launched Nature Towns and Cities. It's a new mission to bring nature back into everyday life. Over the next decade, it will work with 100 towns and cities across all four nations of the UK to improve urban green spaces for all. We have big ambitions for nature towns and cities to help tackle current inequalities in urban green spaces. Over the next 10 years, we want 5 million more people to have access to nature close to home. And we want to make sure at least 1 million more children can play in nature-rich spaces and on their doorsteps. We know spending time in nature makes people healthier and happier and brings communities together, and that thriving towns and cities draw in more investment. Nature benefits too. More green spaces mean more room for plants and wildlife, and also serves to help mitigate the impacts of climate change. In hot weather, city centre temperatures are on average 4 to 6 degrees centigrade, that's 39 to 43 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than in the countryside, with the dark, hard surfaces of buildings and roads absorbing and storing heat. More green space can help balance out that tendency, while trees can help improve air quality by absorbing pollutants, such as nitrogen oxides emitted by traffic. Quality green space can help to reduce flooding risk, slowing down surface water runoff so water can sink into the ground, reducing the pressure on drainage systems. The mission has begun with £15.5 million of Heritage Fund grants for the first 40 towns and cities. The funding will help local partnerships co-design plans with communities for improving their networks of green space. Leading the way are Birmingham, Plymouth and Bournemouth, Christchurch and Poole. They've been officially recognised as nature cities and nature towns for their ambitious plans to put nature at their heart through improving community pride, health and well-being, nature recovery and climate resilience. Over the next 10 years, we hope to unlock £1 billion of public, private and philanthropic investment into urban nature in places like these. The challenge is urgent, but there is still time to act. 10 years from now, we'll look back, knowing many more people can enjoy the kind of spaces Octavia Hill dreamed of, where, as she said, whispers of better things come to us gently.
Written by an anonymous author, especially for the Mardler magazine, this article is entitled Removing the Rue from February. So many of my friends and family have talked of struggling through a dark, dismal January. Some have done it dry, as in free from alcohol, and all have been recovering from some kind of excess over the festive period, whether it be too much turkey, too many house guests, or too much grief of a more tragic kind. And now they find themselves in yet another dark, dreary, cold month with seemingly little hope of an early spring. So why do I relish February every year? Let's explore three possible reasons, namely my birthday, Valentine's Day, and Pancake Day. Valentine's Day has not done it for me on the whole. My best Valentine's Day occurred when I was 17 and received a mystery bouquet of real roses and a silk heart adorned with silk roses at the same time. A gesture too extravagant to be a prank by any of my close family or friends. And interestingly, the roses on both gifts were yellow, although the heart itself was red. I was not dating anyone at the time and only had two suspects in mind, a friend's older brother and a friend I had made when visiting my stepfather in hospital. I ruled out the second as he knew my stepfather's surname and not my original name. The bouquets were sent to my birth name. So I had only one vague suspect and no confidence to follow up with any questions to either him or his sister. I remained ignorant to this day as to who sent them. I grew to enjoy the frustration of others at my disinterest in pursuing this generous mystery suitor. Years later, when my marriage ended and I had to re-embrace a solo lifestyle, I found myself once again very settled into my own activities and interests, with no priority placed on finding a future Valentine. Despite persistent encouragement from family and friends to the contrary. Instead, every 14th of February, I would host a Galentine's evening where my solo girlfriends and I could indulge each other and all feel very much whole, loved and understood, despite not having current life partners. Then 2 years ago, still very much single, on Valentine's Day itself, I moved from the Midlands back to Norfolk and into a house I have loved from the moment I saw it online. So I had a new reason to celebrate the day last year as my moving in anniversary. But furthermore, this year, having met someone new at this late stage in life, I will actually write a card to and hopefully receive one from someone I love. So my February is looking better already. But whether you love and embrace, hate or ignore Valentine's Day, you can take solace in the fact that you are halfway through the month and that the next very special day of Pancake Day is just around the corner. You may be gluten or dairy free, even vegan, but there are pancakes to suit all diets. Maybe a thin French crepe or savoury galette are your style, or thick, fluffy American pancakes served in a stack with mega spoonfuls of maple syrup. But many of us will still be going for the English traditional batter, fried, flipped and covered in lashings of lemon juice and caster sugar before being rolled up and sliced into curled ribbons. By the time this article reaches you, you'll be counting your Valentine's cards from this year, or writing it off, as the case may be, and you will already have moved on from pancakes to fasting for Lent or to life as normal. In my case, my birthday, another reason to celebrate in February, will also have been and gone. This year, I don't mind it passing by quickly and almost unnoticed, but last year was a big one, and I must admit to overindulging for almost the entire year. My bank balance and my waistline will both bear witness to this. So please, if your bank balance and waistlines are bothering you after Christmas, take solace in knowing that mine are far more badly damaged. Delight in a little Schadenfreude at my expense, my gift to you. So, as you listen to this, there is little more than a week left of February, but it is the beginning of the new Chinese zodiac year. It started this year on our aforementioned Pancake Day, namely 17th of February. This year is the year of the Fire Horse. The horse is one of the 12 zodiac signs which rotate in the same order each cycle. The five elements of wood, fire, earth, metal and water also rotate in that order, but change every 2 years, making a 10-year cycle. So that means that it takes a 60-year cycle for the same animal sign to meet the same underlying element again. Last year, the wood snake came round again for the first time since the year of my birth. Apparently, being a snake is a good thing, the best one being the dragon, of course, but the snake is seen as related. So anyone celebrating their 60th birthday after Pancake Day this year was born in the year of the Fire Horse, whereas if it comes after the 6th of February next year, it was the year of the Fire Goat, also known as the Ram. It may well help you to while away the last few days of February to delve a little more deeply into the whole structure of Chinese zodiac and compare it with your own belief structures. Use it to re-examine your love life, past, present or future. Or maybe just grab your gardening books down from the shelf and plan what you will be doing outside as soon as the weather shows just a little more encouragement to get out there. But in the meantime, why not do something proactive to cheer up someone else on any random day in February? Smile at them, flip them a pancake, or send them a card with their Chinese horoscope on it, or a flower from your garden. Let's all do our bit to get that roo out of February.
As always, our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include community and planning matters.
Henley's estate agents in Cromer has been purchased by the Sowerby's Group, which now has 9 branches across Norfolk. Henley's was established in 2016 and is based in newly refurbished offices on West Street. Sowerby has branches in Burnham Market, Dereham, Fakenham, Holt, Hunstanton, King's Lynn, Norwich, Wotton and now Cromer. It said the acquisition is part of its wider expansion strategy to integrate established high-performing local agencies into the group. Lloyd Sandy, Managing Director of Sowerby's Group, said, "Henley's has developed an excellent reputation within the Cromer market over the past decade. The team has built a respected and well-run business, and we are pleased to welcome them into the group. This acquisition supports our long-term growth plans across the region, strengthening our presence in key locations while retaining the local identity and service standards that underpin both brands. We are committed to investing in our high streets and ensuring they continue to thrive as vibrant centres of the communities they serve." Henley's will continue to operate from its Cromer office under its existing name. The existing team also remain, with Simon Dale joining the business as residential sales manager. Jeff Cox, founder of Henley's, said, "I am pleased to see the Henley's name continue to grow under the stewardship of the Sowerby's Group. The values we established remain at the heart of the business, and I am confident the team will continue to serve the local community with the same professionalism and care."
An East Anglian estate agent has acquired the former office building of a controversial dog handling school as its new headquarters. Miners and Brady, which has branches across Norfolk and Suffolk, has acquired the former dog training college premises at Broadland Business Park in Norwich. The estate agent said the 4,800 square foot building will enable it to create a modern workspace to host all of its companies under one roof. It said it plans to hire more than 30 new roles across sales, lettings and mortgages this year, and that its existing offices in Caister, Dereham, Diss, Norwich, Alton Broad and Wroxham will all remain open. Dog Training College, which previously occupied the Broadland Business Park building, entered liquidation last December, despite thousands of students paying £2,000 for online courses to become qualified dog trainers. Students say they have been unable to access their courses via the college's online learning platform or get their money back since the company ceased trading. It was later revealed by this newspaper that the company's accreditation for its courses ended in August last year, meaning students who completed courses through the college since then would not be certified by the CPD Standards Office, as advertised by the company. An update on the Dog Training College website says, "The DTC brand has been acquired and is under new ownership." However, students say they have been receiving messages from the college's social media accounts asking them to continue paying money, despite the alleged new owners not yet being announced. Miners and Brady said in a social media post announcing the acquisition that it is investing in the future. "Our key focus is to deliver unrivalled training and development for our people, coupled with the centralisation of departments to drive greater efficiency and collaboration," the estate agent said. Last month, Miners and Brady appeared in an HMRC report of businesses that have not complied with money laundering regulations. The list, published by HMRC on the official UK government website, revealed Miners and Brady had been issued with a £23,400 penalty notice by HMRC for failing to apply for registration at the required time. Miners and Brady received the penalty notice between April the 1st and September the 30th last year. The estate agent claims to have received an apology from the tax office after appealing the fine, and that the appeal has been accepted to go through alternative dispute resolution. HMRC published the report at the end of January. When it was published, the list stated the tax office had not received an appeal from the estate agent. HMRC updated the report on February the 2nd to say an appeal had been received. HMRC said the published list is accurate and that it can't comment further than what has been published. In a statement, Miners and Brady said, "We are aware of the recently published HMRC list in connection with fines surrounding AML registration. We can confirm we have appealed this decision and have been successfully accepted to go through ADR to resolve." Miners and Brady has received an apology via phone and in writing from HMRC for being included on the list, which they're looking to remedy.
A Norfolk council has warned homelessness isn't getting any better, as new figures reveal temporary housing numbers have risen by more than 58% in 2 years. Broadland District Council's new budget report shows 104 households are now in emergency housing, up from just 66 2 years ago. The increase has led the council to budget £1 million for emergency B&Bs and nightly booked accommodation in 2026-27, up from £810,644 the previous year. At a cabinet meeting this week, council leaders said the authority has a duty to continue spending. Sue Holland, the leader of Broadland, said, "It's not getting any better. The problem is still there. The last thing people who are struggling need is to be in a bed and breakfast. It's very expensive for the council, but it's really not ideal for people with children." Natasha Harpley, deputy leader, added, "It is absolutely the moral thing to do, and I'm really thankful that we are continuing to invest so heavily." To combat the rising demand, the council has unveiled new measures, including a £2 million programme looking to purchase more council-owned properties for temporary housing. The authority currently owns 52 bed spaces and hopes the expansion will save £23,000 over the coming tax year by reducing reliance on expensive private accommodation. It follows the rollout of a joint homelessness strategy with South Norfolk Council last year, which set out aims to purchase more properties to house the homeless. Broadland is also aiming to save £231,000 through a new leasing model aimed at managing private properties to provide suitable accommodation while achieving value for money. The Cabinet has recommended creating a new homelessness reserve using these savings to help mitigate potential cost pressures. Broadland Council will vote on the budget at a full council meeting next Thursday. Our last few articles cover more planning as well as a new osteopathy clinic and an appeal from the Fire Brigade for more considerate parking.
A decision on plans for a new discount store in Norfolk's poshest town is set to be made within weeks. Lidl's bid to build a new store off Nightjar Road in Holt is on track to be discussed at North Norfolk District Council Development Committee next month, it has been revealed. District Councillor for the town, Connor Rouse, announced the news in a post on social media and said, "The application for the Lidl on Nightjar Road site is very close to completion and is on track to be brought forward for voting to the Development Committee meeting in March. Mr. Rouse added that if the development is approved, the road will become an adopted highway under Norfolk County Council, and said discussions were underway to seek further safety improvements to the roundabout. Little by little, it is getting closer, and we thank you for your patience," he said. The retail giant submitted its application to the council last July to build the store as part of the Heath Farm development of more than 200 homes, sparking a mixed reaction from locals. Many were supportive of the scheme, with one saying, "We desperately need a more affordable shop, one which has enough choice and availability for a weekly, even monthly shop." However, there have been several objections which raise concerns about the proposed location, the impact on the town centre, noise and traffic. Others have questioned why Lidl had not chosen the old Station Way site, which its fierce competitor Aldi has now earmarked for its own store in its own planning bid. Aldi revealed its plan for the town last month, and argued that it would have less of a negative impact on the town centre trade than Lidl, and called for the refusal of its rival's application out of the two. The company also requested that the applications should be determined at the same time.
Plans have emerged for new bungalows in a North Norfolk village. Mark Forster has applied for permission to build 9 homes in High Kelling, on the edge of Holt, from North Norfolk District Council. The site, which is off Heathfield Road, has been used in the past as grazing land, but it has been said that it has mostly become overgrown with brambles and small self-seeded trees. The application is for planning in principle at this stage.
A new osteopathy clinic has opened its doors in a Norfolk town as its founder aims to help as many people as possible recover from sports injuries. Apollo Health Collective has opened in its new clinic off Station Approach in Sheringham to offer a range of treatments for sports injuries and day-to-day pains and aches. From a personal training studio to a biomechanics centre and even a reformer Pilates studio in the pipeline, the new site is a big expansion from the company's clinic in the town's medical centre. And for the osteopath and founder of the company, Chris Greenslade, this is a major step forward to provide support for people in North Norfolk. He said, "I think we have a great opportunity to do something really good for the local community. Particularly in coastal areas, there has been an initiative nationwide to improve healthcare because, unfortunately, surgeries in the area are overwhelmed. I think if we can fill that gap in a small way, and hopefully by people utilising our services, we can keep people out of the GP surgeries for longer. The reason you go into a job like this is that you want to help as many people as possible, and that's the goal with this service. Osteopathy is a way of treating and preventing health problems, such as sports injuries and arthritis, by moving, stretching and massaging a person's muscles and joints." Mr. Greenslade, who grew up in Wyndham and went to college in Dereham, started the company in 2020 in London under the name Apollo Recovery and Performance. However, Mr. Greenslade moved back to Norfolk in 2021. He took over the North Coast Osteopath Clinics in Coltishall and Sheringham Medical Practice after osteopath Barbara Hunter retired, and soon it was absorbed into the Apollo brand. But for the past 18 months, he was looking for a new premises to expand his practice, and in December he got the keys to Waterbank House. In the coming months, massage and sports therapists are set to join the team alongside a reformer Pilates teacher.
A new statement issued by Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service has reminded motorists to leave enough space for fire engines to pass when they park. It also urged people to check that their vehicle is not blocking any fire hydrants. "Could a fire engine get through in an emergency?" a spokesman for the service said. "It's vital we can get to a scene quickly, as every second counts. As you park, please ensure there would be room for a fire engine to get past, and also that your vehicle has not blocked fire hydrants. Thank you for your support and for helping us to save lives." This is not the first time Norfolk Fire and Rescue Service has had to issue a plea of this nature. In July 2024, the warning was accompanied by a series of images of parking, which caused problems for crews on rural roads in particular.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listening liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website.
Sorry, I messed that up completely.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet, or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website at mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please, remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Preston. Editing and producing this issue was Trudy Box. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!